Welcome, everyone, to Filmstrips, the podcast bringing us back to 1982. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
So, yes, folks, last week we took a look at a... Well, okay, we didn't really take a look. Tried to take a look at a little film called Highlander 2, which didn't... If you've listened to the episode, you now know that didn't quite work for us.
Much like Highlander 2, The Quickening didn't work for its producers.
Yes, that is certainly true. However, it was a film that had, you know, a certain actor by the name of Alan Rich in it, who played a character that we never talked about in any version of that conversation. And he brings us to a little film called Eating Raoul from 1980, as I noted at the start of the episode, 1982. A dark comedy, and we'll get into that in a little bit, and it's what that means. But yeah, so first of all, Andrew, nice to talk to you again. It's been a little bit after our technical glitches.
Yes, I was also forced to delay this episode a bit because I was having a lot of trouble getting that Nazi out of my kitchen. Nice to be here, though, Dave, and always nice to talk to you. How have you been? You just came back from a vacay.
Yes, I did, and I am rested, I am recharged, and ready to record this and then edit it the following morning, and then hopefully have it posted by that night,
Ooh, it's good to have goals, everybody, and, yes. This may be the first episode where, we didn't actually explain the conceit at the very beginning. For those just tuning in, Filmstrips is a weekly podcast where Dave and I discuss any film that we can possibly get our grubby hands on. The only requirement is that it needs to have some connection to the film that we watched previously. So yes, so we're going through the figure of Alan Rich from Highlander 2 to Eating Raoul. Now, Dave, this was your pick, correct?
Yes, it is. That is true.
Now, I guess let me ask you then, Eating Raoul is not a film that probably most people are familiar with, and I'm not saying that in the whole, oh, well, this week we're looking at a film that's probably a little too cool for you guys to know about. No, this is, I think, a safely slept-on film. So I guess my question is, what made you decide to go in this direction?
Okay, so a couple things right off the bat. Number one, this movie's just, to tip my hand right off the bat, really good. I'm a little biased. I really wanted to look at a good movie this week. Which, again, complete flip from Highlander 2, although that was an entertaining film.
Yeah, it's not good. It's amazing.
Yeah, just for all the wrong reasons. In this instance, we're looking at what I at least believe to be a good movie. We'll see whether Andrew agrees or disagrees with that as we go here. But I think there's a couple things, reasons to kind of take a look at this one. Number one, again, one of the things that we're talking about here is this is very much an independent film coming out in 1982, which is sort of at the point where the 70s have pretty much died as that sort of, you know, free reign of, you know, we can get away with anything type era that I think it's sometimes misrepresented as being. I mean, certainly it was way more, there was way more freedom of that period than most others. At the same time, we tend to overstate just, you know, the fact that, you know, all these crazy independent films or, you know, radical films that were coming out in that era when, you know, the studios were still cranking out, you know, major, high-cost blockbusters and other types of films as the majority of its content, so...
Yeah, because we've talked about the Hollywood Renaissance before and sort of, yeah, in an effort to make money and staunch the fiscal bleeding, how the studios give more free rein to the directors. There's a lot more of the European art house influence on American domestic pictures, usually made like smaller scale, smaller budget. They'll say yes to anything because it's probably going to recoup. But there are also directors that, even working within the Hollywood Renaissance and that brief window that it lasted, even that was too stifling. And so there's still this undercurrent of truly independent American film. And, you know, you can sort of look at maybe Easy Rider sort of is the opening salvo there. But there have always been more people making films than the ones that are getting released in theaters. And there are more directors making films and scraping together their own personal vanity projects than the ones that you read about in Variety. And I would say, yeah, Eating Raoul firmly seems to fall into the second category.
That is very much the case, and we'll get more into the production background on that one in Eating Raoul in a little bit here. But beyond that, this is also a film that, you know, when we say it's a certainly a cult film, and I think when most people think of cult films, they think of films that sort of have a diehard following that aren't quite mainstream. But even within cult film, I think there's even a subsector of cult movies where we get away from even things that seem remotely sort of populist in some way. Like, I mean, let's face it, Evil Dead, you know, is a cult movie, but it's still playing very staunchly within a well-established genre, and in many ways is trying to appeal to the buckets of blood and gore audience as well. It does it amazingly well. But, let's be honest, it had a bit of a marketable element to it.
Yeah, it's not a cult film the same way that John Waters' Pink Flamingo or Female Trouble, the way that those are cult films.
Yeah, and this film, Eating Raoul, and it's good that you bring up John Waters, because what we have here is a film that sort of falls in between the lines, where it's not quite extreme like John Waters is in its idiosyncratic nature and its far-out content. But, yeah, this is a film where the fact that this was made and eventually released by 20th Century Fox is kind of amazing, because I have a hard time imagining many studios would release this film, not because of its outlandish content per se, just because what would you do with this?
Market certainly a film like the one that we're talking about this week? This is a film like Evil Dead, especially people who have read any of Bruce Campbell's books, which are well worth reading, I would like to say. But I mean, Evil Dead was, it was always designed as a project to make money, like most films are. You know, whereas Eating Raoul, it's just, you never get the sense that there was ever going to be a way for this film to be, like, a hit or even make its money back. Like, it feels very overtly like a case of Paul Bartel sitting down saying, you know, I want to make a movie about this, and I don't care if 10 people go to see it, I am going to make this movie. It is going to be exactly what I want it to be, and it's up to fate to decide.
Yeah, and we will note that this film, it was a very modest success relative to its budget, but again, we'll get into more of that later. But yeah, this is a film that's just very peculiar and kind, one of a kind in many ways. But it's also, I think, things we haven't really touched upon in the show yet, is the idea of the dark comedy. We've had films that have flirted with it or might technically qualify. Certainly Where the Buffalo Roam has aspects of it that I think would certainly lend itself to being considered a dark comedy. But certainly when we discussed it, we didn't look at it under that lens.
And I don't think a film like Where the Buffalo Roam is as, it's not as dark as it might think of itself as. Whereas a film like Dead Man, which has moments where it's incredibly funny, that is not a film where I would say like it structures itself as a comedy first and foremost. Whereas what we have with Eating Raoul, like above all, this film is a comedy. And so it's the first real chance to explore like what exactly does that mean as a hybridized category.
Exactly. And on top of which, I mean, it certainly offers a lens to look at what it does right in terms of what we mean within the idea of what a dark comedy is and how that can sometimes go spectacularly right or really, really terribly wrong. So I would say that those are sort of the general strands I think we'll be following. And certainly as we get into this, the film's position and take on where American culture was circa 1982, particularly in Southern California, is bound to be a major discussion topic as we go forward.
Yeah, it turns out Woody Allen isn't the only one that hates California.
Yeah, so beyond that, I guess it's time probably to get into the film itself. And what I think it's, before we even get into the background details of this film, it's probably a good idea to provide a plot synopsis of this movie. So we are, as usual on this show, we are going to spoil the heck out of it. So if you haven't seen the film, keep that in mind. Although, I would say that
if they've read the title of the film, they're spoiling part of it.
They're spoiling part of it. And I don't think that this is a film you can necessarily spoil by describing the plot, per se.
Yeah, we sort of ran into the same thing with Highlander 2, where it's that disconnect between the film as giving rise to a certain narrative versus the film as a system you must experience. And yeah, like the plot description of this film is pretty thin, almost superficial. Like, it seems like just a setup for gags and that. And yet what this film is in its viewing is so unique and so unlike anything else that was happening contemporaneously, and even unlike a lot of films being made now.
Yeah, so to just dive right on into it. Eating Raoul, which was written by Richard Blackburn and Paul Bartel himself, and Bartel is both the director and star of the film, focuses on a couple named the Blands. We have Mary Bland, played by Mary Voronov, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, it sounds close enough to me. I mean, I don't know her, but
yeah. And Paul Bland, played by the late Paul Bartel, who are this couple that have a dream, and that dream is they want to own their own restaurant, Paul and Mary's Country Kitchen.
Which is like the most generically inoffensive name for anything to be like. My lifelong dream is to open a country kitchen. I just think there's something really endearing about that. And maybe it's just because, like, rose-colored glasses, because I finally quit my job at the restaurant. But, there's just something wholesome about that.
Absolutely. And they just, they live, however, despite, having some, as they see it, a fair amount of taste and good taste. They live, struggle a little bit just above maybe the poverty line, I guess is the best way to put it. They live in a rundown apartment, which has been furnished with Mary's mother's, vintage 1950s furniture, as the film notes. Paul works at a, selling wine at a pretty much your local,
it's a liquor store, like the scummy one where they keep the sawed off underneath the register. And he's there. We're introduced to him as he's arguing with customers how they shouldn't buy that $1.50 bottle. They really need to buy this one for $3.50 because their guests will know the difference.
Exactly.
So right away, Paul in particular is immediately telegraphed as sort of a fish out of water. Like, he is a man that tries to hang on to, like, his culture and his tastes and, like, sort of his love of the aesthetics, even though that places him at a complete remove from everybody around him.
Absolutely. And his wife works as a nurse who has to put up with the patients who, for the most part, are sexually harassing her there and just putting up with the demeaning aspects of this life. But, she loves her husband, they have a dream, they want to accomplish it. It's just, unfortunately, that they don't have the economic means to match their supposed view of what their status is. And it also doesn't help that they happen to be in a building that surrounds them with swingers, which they cannot stand. And for those of you who don't know what swinging is, Andrew, would you like to find us a nice euphemism to explain this as politely as possible?
I love how you're playing to my strengths here. Swingers, yeah. I mean, the concept of non-monogamous relationships. Flower power ended, but certain ideas of free love remained. I think that, would that be an okay working definition without losing our clean listening tag?
I would think so. And basically, as we sort of see, that many of these people like to congregate together and what happens in an apartment generally stays in an apartment.
Yeah, everyone drops their keys, and then, you know, Roy Scheider pops up and says, we're going to need a bigger fishbowl.
Ba-dum-dum. At any rate, so, yeah, this is, you know, the nature of their existence, but, you know, tragedy strikes. Paul loses his job, and, you know, it suddenly puts their vision of this future at risk. And when a swinger party guest for their next door neighbor happens to show up mistakenly thinking their apartment is where the party's taking place, Paul and Mary, you know, at first trying to get rid of him and bring him back to his proper party.
With very good manners at the same time. I mean, they don't want to appear rude as they're getting this drunken sex passed out of their apartment. But one thing leads to another, and next thing they know, the Blands have a dead body on their kitchen floor.
Yes, and ultimately, they end up deciding out of frustration and sort of weird self-justification, such as the fact that this may have been the individual who canceled their credit cards.
That's one of my favorite bits in the entire movie. Go on.
Yes. They, you know, quickly figure out they need to get rid of the body. They decide they could just take the money because, you know, this guy probably had it coming and probably messed them over personally, again, hence over the credit cards. And, you know, that would be that. From there, it's like, hey, they got this money and, you know, they're just going to carry on their merry way. But tragedy soon strikes when, you know, in an effort to gather all together the $20,000 necessary to buy the piece of property in which to start their little country kitchen, Paul goes to sell at least a portion of his wine collection that he's willing to part with, only to have it stolen from him in a swindle job. Meanwhile, Mary's efforts to get a loan from the bank fall flat when the bank manager, Mr. Leach, played by one Buck Henry.
The one Buck Henry.
Yeah, turns out to once again be a sexually harassing individual who basically tries to force Mary into engaging in acts that would persuade him to approve her loan.
Well, he's simply trying to find out whether or not she's the kind of customer that the bank could do flourishing business with.
Yes, and after, you know, rejecting his advances in a scene that ultimately involves security dragging her out, ultimately the Blands sort of stumble upon the idea, well, that swinger had a lot of money that we inadvertently killed.
Yeah, almost $300.
What if we did this again? Because, you know, it's not like these are people that the world's going to miss as they foresee it. And thus, a business strategy is engaged. Kill swingers, take their money, and ultimately, you know, put all this towards, you know, getting the $20,000 to buy their country kitchen. You know, a nice wholesome little tale.
Exactly. And they're living a dream and making sacrifices for us. And of course, things get complicated when they, I wouldn't say befriend, but they come across Raoul, the titular Raoul, a locksmith and small-time cat burglar who talks a big game and just happens to walk in as the Blands are trying to dispose of two dead bodies. The three of them get drawn into a larger criminal plot, and eventually a really strange little love triangle as well, and everything proceeds to go from bad to worse.
Precisely. So, if this film sounds like a dark comedy based on some fairly grisly content, you wouldn't be wrong.
Yeah, because to step back, let's foreground once again. This film, if it's anything, it is a comedy first and foremost.
Yes. And, you know, this is certainly not the only film to deal with grisly content. You get things such as The Great Ravenous from the late 90s, which is basically a film about cannibals out there, and certainly get films such as Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, Stanley Kubrick's dark comedy masterpiece. So, you know, it's not like this film is without some, you know, a broadly defined tradition that it is part and parcel of. And yet, this is not like a lot of dark comedies in many ways, because the thing about dark comedy is this. Typically, yes, it deals with very dark subject matter. overall. And, you know, it can get grisly, it can get dark, and sometimes I think one of the things that a lot of films struggle with is the notion of drifting into mean-spiritedness in terms of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Where it's, you know, the comedy gets so dark and it feels like it's punching down at individuals. And
I think that may also be a distinction between certainly how we use these terms popularly, because I know that conceptually, you know, there's a much larger history and a specific history, but it's also maybe the distinction between comedy and satire as well. Like, in the sense that American Psycho, I would term as, like, an amazing piece of satire. But at the same time, you would feel very ill at ease referring to it as a comedy. And it's weird, because, like, Eating Raoul, in many respects, has a definite satiric thrust to it. In that it's trying to make a commentary on LA and the people that live within it and various other threads. But at the same time, like, it's always almost to a bizarre effect. Like, really, the chief interest in any scene is getting that gut laugh out of the audience. And, like, there's a reliance on sight gags, on, like, screwball dialogue and rapid wordplay, on verbal and visual punning that really generally is absent from a lot of sort of social satires, because they want to more so foreground, like, they want to foreground the message, and in doing so foreground why what they're taking on is so important.
Absolutely. And then, you know, but I think another thing that sort of really distinguishes this is when you start describing the content of this is a couple who's going around murdering people and taking their money, you probably get an image in your head of a sort of bloody, you know, maybe bloody slapstick type film, or something maybe even closer to William Friedkin's Amazing Killer Joe, which is so pitch black. But it's a very, you know, the comedy of that one is exceptionally bleak and nasty.
It's like you laugh because there's no other response that will allow you to keep your sanity. You know, yeah, it's like people watching videos of guys getting hit by trains, and they have that response where they're like, oh my! And then they burst into wild laughter because there's no way to rationally fathom that which you're seeing.
Exactly. And that's not Eating Raoul. This is a film that, for, you know, right from like frame one with its, you know, very peculiar opening credits, foregrounds itself as very much a almost live action cartoon in many ways, because again, what is the Andrew, would you care to explain to our listeners how the method in which Paul and Mary decide to murder individuals?
Well, because like the opening credits, it's like a neon yellow font, and for some reason like reminds me visually of old Warner Brothers cartoons, even though I know that doesn't really make sense. But also, the cast, as introduced in the credits, the actor's name pops up, and then there's this weird sort of caricatured quasi-photograph of them that really, like, flattens them out and makes them look very self-consciously and artificially cartoony. And, yeah. I mean, that's a thread that carries through with sort of the zaniness of the film. But even their method of disposing of victims, like, you know, you can have all sorts of schemes. You can poison people with arsenic. You can, you know, use an ice pick or the other popular movie murder weapons of the time. This film, they use a frying pan, a domestic object that just makes, like, that cartoonish thunk noise every time they do. It's surprisingly bloodless, and yet, you know, in real life, that would make for a fine weapon. Probably better if you bought cast. But in some ways, like, I think that signals not only just, like, the ineptness of Paul and Mary as sort of wannabe killers for hire, but also it just, it makes me think of, like, in classic cartoons where, you know, somebody's trying to break in a window and someone drops a bowling ball on their head, or someone drops an anvil on them, or somebody sticks their fingers in a mousetrap. Like, the frying pan seems to belong to that pantheon of slapsticky weapons, where in real life, you know, you drop a bowling ball on someone's head, and, well, they're probably dead. But according to cartoon logic, it just means you'll get a lump theatrically rising out of their head until it becomes a mountain.
Exactly. And this film, for the entirety of its running time, maintains this peculiar tone where that kind of logic and attitude is sustained throughout. Because this isn't quite reality as we know it. Because everything is heightened, both in terms of performance, in terms of the very minimalist production design due to budget. The odd thing is, it's all of a piece and all flows sort of naturally, because there is nothing... It's not artifice in the same way when you say start talking about something like, say, Dick Tracy, where they've created this completely artificial world in which they exist. This is recognizably Hollywood we are looking at here. And yet everything, even though it's so grimy and downtrodden, is oddly colorful and, you know, just, again, because of the way in which people bounce and work their way through the scenes, very energetic and cartoonish. From start to finish, beginning with our central cast of Mary Warnoff and Paul Bartel themselves, as Paul and Mary. And they are just a fascinating, you know, pair in which the way they play off of one another and how they develop this very peculiar relationship that exists between the pair. Because when we say that they are husband and wife, but their marriage, I would say, does not fit what most people would consider a conventional understanding of how that works.
Yeah, they're a married couple the same way that June and Ward Cleaver on Leave It to Beaver are a married couple. And, like, this is a film where, at one and the same time, it's entirely concerned with bodies. Whether it's, you know, the killing of them or the exploitation of them, like the tactile physicality of them, you know, the sex trade and the body politic and, you know, the rights concerning all of those matters. But at the same time, it's also strangely disembodied at the same time. Like, there's a lot of murder, but all of it's strangely, like, bloodless and kind of inert. And, like, this is a film that's absolutely littered with discussions and depictions of human sexuality. But Paul and Mary's relationship, it's contained in, like, this... The same way that, like, I remember when we were talking about Street Fighter, how, like, Bison's plan, it's not that he wants to seduce Chun-Li, it's not that he wants to take her by force, it's that he wants to romance her so she falls in love with him. And, like, it's that same level of cartoonish superficiality. But I think the fact that there is so much personality being expressed in the set design, in the characters, that even without, like, any sense of who these people are or why they are the way they are, like, even the most bit players in this film, they're all given dialogue that just indicates such a fascinating backstory behind everybody.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, the film is blatantly... They are the figures of satire in this film. They are very much the sort of, in some ways, you know, ultra-reserved, ultra-regressive sort of target of Reagan America. Yeah, you know, this is the ideal thing.
Satire always needs to have a clear target. I mean, that's the general rule of it anyway. There needs to be that one unmistakable object that's being mocked. And in this film, Paul and Mary really do function as kind of like yuppies writ large. Everything about, you know, the sort of the flower children that grew up and got disillusioned and cut their hair and started working on Wall Street, you know, it's like, I feel like that whole archetype of living is what the Blands represent, and I feel like the film is pretty biting towards that. Yet, well, the film, like, is also equally biting towards, like, the flower generation itself.
Well, and this is the thing, because the film, like I said, is like this, again, because the Blands are the sort of, like, lost 1950s couple that somehow wandered into the 1980s and just reject, just horrified by what's happened.
Yeah, they're the country couple that around was proud them. To stay home from Woodstock.
The thing is, it's not like the world around them is presented as this nice thing, because the thing is, yes, they are killing what they refer to as swingers and people who clearly believe in the sexual revolution versus this couple that has, you know, certainly presented as either ambiguously asexual or not. The film very much gives it this Leave It to Beaver style approach, as you were saying, Andrew. But what's fascinating is that and kind of interesting, because I don't know how much of it is intentional or how much of it is in hindsight now. What we end up seeing with the swingers in this film, the sort of people, is that we've seen that the flower power and free love generation has curtailed into asexual politics, which is as regressive and violent and horrifying as anything that they were quote-unquote fighting back against initially.
I think that's really interesting, though, in the sense that this, despite how we've described the film, it doesn't really have clear heroes or villains, but rather it gives a lot of dead bodies, and some of them we feel are a lot more justified than others, and probably the kills in the film that we feel the least bad about, it's probably not a coincidence that they're all white men with a ton of money in positions of power that are using those positions to prey off other people.
Well, and that's exactly it. I mean, the film, the world in which the Blands inhabit, we are, you know, the Blands are clearly targets for satire, but I think the reason, the number one, we recognize that the world they're responding to is, in some ways, we kind of see why they're repulsed, particularly Mary, when you consider all the, you know, flat-out sexual aggression that's directed towards her throughout the film. And not in subtle fashion. Because it's a recurring theme throughout this movie, is that everybody seems to, you know, doesn't matter how often she says no, they won't listen. Number one.
It's like, and she has no autonomy of her own body until probably three quarters of the way through the film. But it's weird, because it's one of those areas where it's like, okay, well, if this is satire, we get it, and the longer you're just demonstrating that, well, women are treated like objects and not listened to, it just becomes more and more uncomfortable. But I feel like the fact that this film is so over the top in other areas, like, it doesn't get away with it the same way that, like, certain modern dramas could. Like, it's not deploying that necessarily to a larger point beyond the point you think it's making from the outset.
No, it is. And I think the other thing, though, the reason, I mean, to get into the sort of moral quagmire of, you know, why the Blands, even though they are clear targets and, you know, we were sort of discussing before the show, possibly the worst people in this movie, in a film filled with nothing but terrible people, as Richard Beltran, the individual, or Robert Beltran, sorry, who plays Raoul the film, gleefully notes in some of the special features on the Criterion release of this. The thing about it is that partly why it works is the fact that the, unlike other figures in dark comedy, the actual aims of the Bland are relatively modest. And, you know, there's a finite level degree to which they are operating. I mean, this is not an ongoing scheme that they're planning to run forever. You know, they're just going to kill enough swingers so they can open their kitchen. That's it. That's the entirety of the thing.
And I mean, and that really gets underscored by the film's conclusion, because I know we're skipping ahead a bit, but there is a statement made to the effect of, look, whatever happened before, that doesn't matter now, because we got the down payment, the restaurant's ours, and everything worked out okay. And the way that ending proceeds, you genuinely do believe, like, they're never going to hurt anybody ever again, because they got what they wanted, and now they're no longer a problem. And, I mean, I feel like if you ever wanted to condemn, like, baby boomers writ large, that would be one way to do it. That, look, I mean, once they got what they wanted, they were totally harmless, but yeah, I mean, I feel like that is sustained through the film long enough that that is part of the critique it's forming. But go on, Dave.
But there's that, but I think it also then ends up being contrasted by Raoul, who, I mean, as a figure, is presented as predatory without an end game necessarily. In fact, one of the big things is, as we sort of know, there ends up being a sort of love triangle between Paul and Mary, where even though, again, as we've sort of noted, one of the big the cornerstone seemingly of Paul and Mary's relationship, even though it's never stated as such, is the fact that there isn't a sexual component to it whatsoever. The thing about, you know, she ends up having an affair with Raoul, and Raoul ends up getting this big grandiose thing where, first of all, he tries to outright murder Paul so that Mary will be with him. But when he shows up at the end and basically holds Paul at gunpoint and starts explaining his grand vision of things, where there's going to be a larger operation with all sorts of women, you know, bringing in these swingers that they can kill and then take their money, and that, you know, he'll have, you know, Mary won't have to do it because she'll now be his wife, and, you know, she won't have to work to do anything. You get the sense that he's, you know, Raoul is basically almost the corporate version of it. It's like, you know, I'm going to franchise this. I'm going to make it bigger and bigger, and the end game is his greed, period. There is no larger vision.
Point. You know, I've never thought of it in terms of, like, the corporatization, but that really is what he's proposing. It's, I'm going to take your artisanal mom-and-pop-style murder, and I'm just going to streamline production on it. I'm going to roll it out so we can replace all the parts as needed.
Exactly, and it's this weird thing where, you know, that's the kind of why we reject Raoul, and it's also notable because Raoul commits one on-screen murder, and his is the one murder that breaks from the frying pan to the head, you know, clean gag, where he straight up chokes a man to death on screen.
Now, he's doing this beats, no less.
Yeah, now, in the context of the scene, you know, he's just done this after this individual has attempted to rape Mary. So, you know, certainly we are inclined to side with Raoul for good reason. But the film definitely makes a sort of, because of the way in which the scene plays out, that, number one, Raoul's, you know, form of violence is more transgressive in how it is. It's not this clean, you know, bonk to the head that the Bland seem to have. And this ends up being linked to his own sexuality and how that ends up appealing to Mary in a roundabout way. And it's such a weird, complex set of stuff going on there, and it's kind of hard to unpack in terms of just what Bartel is thinking or doing necessarily with it, other than, you know, highlighting the fact that, you know, there is a component to Mary's relationship with Raoul that is, you know, being fulfilled in a way that it isn't with Paul.
Yeah, and that whole sequence, though, is structurally, it's an important sequence because, as you mentioned, that's the one time that Raoul kills somebody, and that's sort of the moment that leads to the affair. But, I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that the guy that gets killed is Ed Begley Jr. acting as a hippie. And he comes in the door, and he's all mellow and tranquil, talking about how, oh, our biggest fear is that the future becomes the past, and all we have is now. Want to smoke some Thai stick? And then when Mary rejects him, though, he immediately turns to anger and gets violent with her and basically throws her down and says, well, too bad, you belong to me. So I think it's not entirely accidental that, like, this is the first time we have, like, a non-swinger presented the same way that the rest of them are. And, like, the hippies and the idea of free love is shown to be a pretty ugly thing here. But as the scene plays out, it becomes stylistically so dissimilar from the rest of the film around it, where, you know, you got the moonlighting and you've got, you know, the hippie beads on the wall, and Mary and Raoul, they end up, like, getting real close to one another. They end up smoking some grass while the music starts swelling. And as Raoul takes his head off screen, it just continues to slowly zoom on Mary's face, and it builds and builds and builds. And then it just ends. And, like watching, that was the one moment in the film that shocked me. Just the presentation of this sequence and what it's doing there in terms of, like, what its targets are. And sort of the idea of Mary also sort of discovering herself. And, like, it just, it comes off as, like, incredibly bold. And even, like, yeah, even more than 30 years after its release. Like, I turned to my partner when that scene was over, and I'm like, did that just happen? How on earth did any studio agree to release that in 1982? But, like, not in the sense of exploitation film, which often runs in sort of the same Venn diagram as cult cinema. This is a film where there's a lot of crassness and there's a lot of vulgarity, but it doesn't feel tasteless. And I know that sounds very strange given all the things we've listed thus far.
Well, the part of it is, I think about it, is how oddly progressive much of what's going on in this film is, because this is a film about the nature of consent. And ultimately, you know, this is a film about the fact that, yeah, you know, consent matters in a way. And I don't know, again, I don't foresee this as something that was clearly going through the mind of the creators when they did this in 82, but it reads so distinctly in 2018 in that way that it's kind of, I think, shocking. Not to mention, part of what you were discussing here is the fact this is a film in which, you know, the big, you know, that close-up you're talking about of Mary as that's going on. Again, this is a film that's about, you know, what's notable is that it's a scene of the pleasure of a woman. It's not aimed as...
I wonder what euphemism you'd go with.
Well, but this is the thing. I mean, it's not aimed at a male audience in the way you would think. I mean, the way in which it's shot, you know, the focus isn't on, hey, look at, you know, Mary Wernernov here. It is set up as, okay, you know, pay attention to her, you know, how she's reacting. Pay attention to what she's feeling in the scene. And yeah,
it's
that
the
feels
performance of the body rather than the body itself.
Yeah, and it's the feeling that, you know, what matters is how she's feeling in this moment. You know, any sexuality of the scene is, you know, ultimately revolves around her. Now, granted, yes, this is a whole sequence about her having an affair, which she ends up lying repeatedly about to her husband. But it doesn't, and I think that's one of those things where, as a, you know, consumer of media, as it were, and narrative storytelling in many forms, that's one of those things that typically bugs the hell out of me. I have this thing where that sense of betrayal really sort of eats at me, as it's like, and it doesn't matter who it's happening. Like, I mean, trust me, you're talking to somebody who, when Matt Murdock in the Daredevil comics cheated on his wife while she was in a hospital, was furious at him.
Some hero that... you turned out to be. No wonder season 2 fell apart.
Like I said, I say this as a Daredevil fan. I love the fact that Matt Murdock's completely screwed up, but I mean, yeah, no, that made me visibly angry. And it's interesting that the film, you never feel, you know, you never feel betrayed by what Mary's doing, because, yeah, you recognize that she's a hypocrite in many ways, particularly at the end when she's trying to play off the Paul. It's like, oh no, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was seduced, or, you know, and he gave me drugs, and it was never, you know, this thing. And it's like, yeah, she's a hypocrite, but you don't feel mad at her, because the entire relationship of these two is the fact that, yeah, you're both morally screwed up hypocrites in many ways.
Yeah, like, the easiest way to give her a pass is just look at Paul and listen to how he treats everybody in the film. And yet, at the same time, like, Raoul is exciting, and you can see why there's that appeal, but at the same time, he's codified as much more dangerous, or more amoral character, because I think, as you pointed out earlier, David, like, Raoul doesn't necessarily seem to have any kind of endgame, and the Blands do, and that's a slight but important distinction, because their plan stops when they get Paul and Mary's country kitchen, which is still so cute. Whereas Raoul, it's just the thrill of the hunt, the thrill of getting money, and as we learn eventually, selling bodies to a dog food company. It's like, he just, everything about him just seems seedy, even from the get-go. Like, he is a locksmith that advertises by putting, like, cheap posters under people's windshields, and then when they allow him into their homes, he rigs a new lock for them that he has the key to, so he breaks in and robs them. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, like, I think also it's there's something to be said for, you know, from the 1960s on, where we see a lot of narratives about sexual and social liberation. And, you know, that's the big takeaway. Whenever you see one of those crummy PBS documentaries about the 60s where it's like, man, everyone was so liberated. We could finally be ourselves, man. And, like, the thing is, what's most interesting about this film to me, and probably its biggest condemnation of hippie culture, is that Mary really does get the choice between the two. She can have her sterile 1950s twin beds and stuffed animals lifestyle with Paul, and, like, we think it's ridiculous when we first see it. And then we understand when she meets Raoul, and it's like, hey, drugs and embodied desire, who would say no to that? But by the end, she ends up choosing to side with Paul. And in doing so, she's rejecting that promise of quote-unquote liberation. And I think that to me is so interesting because we fail to ever consider that not everybody wants to be liberated. And that liberation means something very different to every different individual. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily take Ed Begley Jr. turning into a monster at the drop of a hat to realize that, well, hippie culture is problematic. But, like, there's that moment where it's like, you know what? Some people would prefer a wholesome, asexual life where they get to own their own restaurant, and that's good enough for them. And really, like, who are we to take that away from them, you know? There's always something that seems sort of I guess wrong-headed in trying to argue to people to their face that what they actually want isn't what they actually want. And I think that's been one of the biggest mistakes of, like, 60s onward discourse.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that's one of those key things that's really, you know, fascinating about the film is that, you know, this is, you know, an entire film built around them sort of responding to a world in which, you know, consent does not matter, or at least to the majority of the world, and they're basically rebelling against it. Now, granted, again, they're still murdering people and ultimately engaging cannibalism by the end. But, you know, in the moral relativism of this film, that is slightly less problematic at the end, troubling than the other aspects that were presented with over this film. It also helps that I think, you know, even though the film, you know, seems to take pot shots at swingers and the sort of, you know, again, the sexual revolution that came about during the 60s and it can, its aftermath, the film also gives us characters like Doris, which is the complete, you know, what's fascinating, again, is the sort of peculiar relationship that develops between the Blands and her, because in the case of this film, Doris, as played by Susan Sager?
Sager? I don't know her from anything else, but I really enjoyed her performance in this movie.
Yeah, she shows up early on as a dominatrix at a party that Paul is trying to get the swinger who initially busted into their home back to. But when the when the Blands decide to start putting together their big plan, the first thing they do is they reach out to her because they just so happen to have her business card. And what we come to discover is, no, she's just a suburban mom who, you know, this is just a job to her. And
she's an army wife. And
yeah.
Yeah, that's such a surprisingly woke thing for a zero budget 1982 dark comedy to do. Because the moment that we first meet Doris, like, she's presented as very, very ridiculous and very stock, you know? Like, every 80s teen sex comedy has, like, you know, sort of the iconography of BDSM culture, where it's like, the dominatrix, you know, the assertive woman carrying a bullwhip who's yelling at every man around her. And that's exactly what Doris is presented as. But then we get that scene of her at home where she's out of costume, she's out of character, and she's just giving her son lunch while explaining to these two squares what the finer points of working within the industry is. And, I mean, I'm an arts major. I know some people that don't necessarily fall into square categories. But based off conversations, like, a lot of what Doris is saying is it's not wrong, it's not mischaracterizing, it's not lampooning the culture. Like, it's a fairly accurate expression of how people negotiate their regular everyday lives and the more performative aspects that come out through their own sexuality.
Well, on top of which, she's the most well-adjusted and positive character in this entire film. I mean, yeah, she ultimately tries to help Paul, you know, scare off Raoul when he suddenly is convinced that, you know, quite rightly, Raoul's trying to kill him and take his wife away from him, But, you know, she's happy. We're not made to judge her at any point. We're not supposed to condemn what she does for a living. And on top of which, what's kind of notable is the Blands don't. You know, for all their talk of hating hippies and everything else, it's kind of interesting how, you know, they seem to like Doris and she seems to like them. And there is this weird sort of, again, it's like she's not forcing it upon them. They're just kind of, you know, looking to learn from her. And the way in which there is that mutual respect going on there is rather fascinating. And as you sort of noted, I mean, it's shockingly progressive for, again, a 1982 film that was originally pitched to Roger Corman before he rejected it.
Can't imagine what Corman would have done with it. But yeah, like, and it's such a weird counterpoint because especially the early scenes, like, in the apartment complex itself, like, swingers are equated completely with, like, hedonism and barbarism, pretty much. Like, these are people that they don't care where they are, they just assume, oh, this must be where the party is. Oh, there's a woman, she must be down to play, or whatever. And, like, it does come off as, like, brutish and herd-like and predatory. And then Doris, like, flips that, and through just, she only has a couple scenes in the film where, like, she gets to do much, but, like, in those dialogue exchanges, like, the film really kind of tips its hands and sort of, that's sort of like where those in the know can look to that and be like, oh, so this film actually is a lot more sensitive and grounded towards, like, atypical expressions of sexuality than it first appears. And, like, there's that one really, really interesting moment, which I can't quite repeat here, but Doris makes reference to a particular euphemism for a bedroom act, and the Blands look at each other, and they admit that they don't know what it means. And whereas any other film would play it for a gag, and Doris would explain what it means, and we watch the Blands get shocked and freaked out, Doris just smiles and doesn't comment on it, and just continues on with her point. And I think that is so, that's so clever, because as I've said before, if there's one thing I hate in movies, it's having contempt for your audience. Like, I hate when there's a reference to, like, a classic work of art dropped into something, and then they immediately have to explain it and point out what it's a reference to. Whereas this does the opposite. It's, like, almost using the secret language of, you know, quote-unquote swinger society. But, like, that's almost a moment in the film where it's like, look, If you're in the know, you know what that means. And if you don't know what that means, you're firmly a square, just like the Blands. And so, either you get to mock the Blands for being out of it, or your mockery of them is tempered because the film is really pointing out you are no different than they are. And it's like, that is a brilliant and ballsy move for this film to be pulling off. And it works so well.
No, absolutely. And I mean, this film is, again, it's so much of it is episodic in its structure. And,
very much,
know, we,
so.
And we seem to be in some way sort of jumping all over the map with it. But in turn, again, this is such a tightly thematically focused movie in terms of what it wants to achieve and how it achieves it, that you can't really take anything away from it. It is, I mean, it really is shocking. And I think, again, this is a film that was a labor of love. I mean, basically, its origins lie in the fact that, you know, Paul Bartel and Mary Woronoff were, I guess, frequently cast together in many films produced by Roger Corman. And, you know, Bartel just decided, you know, it's like, well, why don't we just make a film for ourselves? And they, you know, Corman turned them down, and Bartel's approach was basically to say, well, forget it. We'll just start shooting it, and then maybe we can attract investors over it. So they would take the short ends, and for those who don't know what short ends are, they are basically the leftover pieces of film stock that didn't get used when the roll was being shot originally. Shot a few small sequences of the film, showed it to investors. It's like, here, invest in this movie. Bartel even got his parents to invest in this film as well. And, you know, they made this little film for $500,000. Bafflingly not, I mean, and again, nobody could have been getting paid anything. I don't imagine, like, there's no way Ed Begley Jr., you know, probably made more than $100 doing this.
Yeah, which was probably Buck Henry, who at this point, you know, he had written The Owl and the Pussycat, he had written The Graduate, he was famous as a comedian in his own right, and as an actor, and he just shows up. And again, like, I can't imagine he was paid much more than anybody else.
Exactly, and yet, you know, this film really feels like a labor of love from start to finish, and the fact that it actually was picked up by a major distributor and released, I would imagine it was a, you know, small-scale release. I don't think that this thing played in every multiplex across America at the time, but certainly I think that it got enough play and got enough recognition that it's held on to its audience all this time. Is remarkable.
And that and certainly has grown, because, I mean, given its production context, to say that this film would ever get a Criterion release, like, it's crazy. Like, it's sad that sort of this film's reception didn't really happen within Paul Bartel's lifetime, but in the years since, like, this is a film that I feel, usually when we talk about cult films, there's that sense of, like, oh, well, it's terrible, but you just have a soft spot for it. This is a film that has this really weird, endearing quality to it, but it's also, in spite of all its budgetary limitations, like, it's a very competently made film.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's the thing where this is such a... It's a controlled movie, because there is a version of this that where... you could easily allow the actors, because as I've noted, it's a very cartoonish in many regards, and we haven't even gotten to many of the supporting players like Don Steele, aka one of the scene stealers in this movie, where they could go so broad and so over the top that it's just grating, and that's not it. This has a very measured, thoughtful tone throughout that allows for, you know, broad gags, that we sort of see, such as, the, you know, again, Doris returning in her multiple, you know, undercover roles as part of Paul's scheme to drive Raoul away.
And committing fully to all of them.
Exactly. Or, you know, Paul killing an entire hot tub full of swingers by tossing a light into it. Like, these things that, you know, should feel like, you know, this is going into a, you know, slapsticky farce, and yet it all feels of a piece, and it all seems to cohere into a consistent vision. And that's not easy to pull off when you're dealing with something where the subject matter and the tone are sort of really not the type of thing you would think would easily mesh together well. On top of which, you're then throwing in all this delightful, you know, subtext and potential, you know, political readings of it as you go forward as well. That's a really tricky combination to pull off, and you have to give it to Bartel for how he pulls it all together at the end of the day. And I'm kind of sad we never got the planned sequel that he almost got funded in the mid-90s.
Yeah, which would have been, according to Mary Warrenov, that funding was secured like the week that Paul Bartel died. And, you know, I mean, it's Hollywood Apocrypha. I don't know whether or not that's empirically true. But if that's even, you know, has a grain of truth to it, I do find that very sad, because this is a film that I have known about for a very long time, and I only watched for the first time last week. In fact, it is in my often spoken about Roger Ebert home videos on cassette 1980 to 1985, which is still on my bookshelf. Maybe I'll take a picture and put it up on Twitter. But yeah, it was in there then, and I remember as a kid, like, reading the listing and being like, well, I don't know who these actors are, but this movie sounds weird. And sure enough, knowing it was a weird movie and sitting down and watching it, it's like, to call it weird is an understatement. Because, like, you know, a movie like The Begotten is weird, but there's no real value in it. Like, it's not doing anything interesting on a conceptual or a viewership level. Whereas this film is doing a number of insane conceptual moves, and at the same time, like, the ensemble of the cast and just the way they play off each other means that this is a film where every scene has at least one good laugh out of it, too. And, like, imagine if the Abrams brothers ever tried their hand at social commentary other than An American Carol. And, like, this is kind of resembling what that would be. Yeah, just even that opening dialogue, like, the customer at the liquor store and Paula's the salesman. And, you know, he's trying to upsell them on the bottle. And they're like, I don't know, I like this one. I mean, it's hard to beat the price at $1.50. And what's his line? It's, well, lighter fluid is $1 a gallon, but I wouldn't recommend serving it to your dinner guests.
And, like, yeah.
It's just everybody's in their own weird little bubble, but the cast as a whole are all on the same page.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's absolutely the case. And not to mention, I mean, we have it, like, the number of great flipping lines throughout this film is just staggering. I mean, things like even Mary's just little throwaway line, oh, Paul, can you buy another frying pan? I'm just a little squeamish about cooking about in the ones we're using to kill people. I mean, name me another movie that would have that.
Similarly, after Alan Rich, The Point of Connection, let's remember to mention him in this episode, who comes over as a client that does an elaborate role play as a Nazi commandant interrogating Mary. Which is odd, but, you know, after he is dead, like, the Blands are talking, and then Mary starts feeling tired, and then Paul, in, like, the most stock soap opera, like, TV husband way, just gives her a look and says, oh, honey, it's been a late night for the both of us. Why don't you go to bed? I'll bag this Nazi and straighten up a bit, and I'll be right there. But thanks, dear. And especially once Raoul, as Robert Beltran, shows up. For the title character of the film, he's not in it all that much, but that first scene, like, just the rapidity of the dialogue, like, it feels like a Marx Brothers sequence. Because just him walking around and, like, at one and the same time, like, assessing the place for security, but also totally casing the joint. Him answering all the questions with more and more absurd responses, and eventually culminating in him breaking in to find two dead bodies on the kitchen floor. And, you know, the Blands catch him in the act, and that's when he gives his plan to, he'll dispose of the bodies and they'll split the money three ways. And Paul's response is, well, that's not fair. You know, we earned this $1,000. And then Raoul just blinks and goes, you killed two people for less than $1,000? And without missing a beat, Mary pipes in, one of them shortchanged us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, it's so delightful. And even the little throwaway gags or odd beats that this film has that, you know, sort of go by and, you know, it happens and then nobody really comments on it. Like, the way in which Raoul's introduced, because, yeah, he has that first, that scene with the Blands where he's casing their apartment, but he also appears earlier in the film in a very quick glance where Paul just happens to see him exiting an apartment with a bunch of, you know, stuff from this apartment and walking down the hallway, and Paul never comes back to that, never remembers, never puts it together. Yeah, no, it's such a delightful little throwaway gag. Or even things like the whole sequence where Paul goes back to his car, Raoul shows up in another car wearing a mask that doesn't cover up the fact that it's obviously him, and repeatedly tries to run him down, runs circles around Paul in the car. It's like this visceral reaction. And then you cut back to Mary. It's like, oh, I'm sure he's not trying. Nobody's trying to kill you. Like, just The flatness of that is, again, it's cartoonish and it works delightfully.
Yeah, there's an absurdity that everybody commits to. And I think the best scenes in the film, like, allow everyone to sort of reveal that. Even in the Raoul scene, I'm just remembering where they point, he's like, oh, you definitely need to put locks on all your windows, trigger it to an alarm. That'll cost you $900. And they're like, but we're on the fifth floor. And without missing a beat, he just, like, rolls his eyes and shakes his head and says, yeah, you really think that's going to stop them? It's like, they get along with Raoul because even though he's amoral and, like, totally okay with it, and they insist on rationalizing all their actions, like, it's like they speak the common language of insanity. And that is what brings them together.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it's, man, Robert Beltran. Why did this man not have a bigger career? I know he went on to be in Star Trek Voyager, a show that he has repeatedly lambasted in the both while he was on it and in the years since, for good reason. But I mean, it's just like, you look at that show and how it wastes him when he has such great comic chops on display here. And it's like, why did nobody figure this out and put him to better use after this?
And maybe it's also because he's counterpointed with Paul Bartel, who, you know, the character he's playing in this film is very nebbish, but he has a very, very impressive degree of screen presence to him. Like, he's handsome, he just comes into the scene and almost takes it over. And, like, I can see in the right hands, like, him being that bankable commodity. It just, it didn't happen because his breakout role was in an incredibly odd film from 1982 that almost nobody saw.
Well, that and Hollywood racism, I think, is another thing to point out here. Like, certainly, I mean, Beltran, you know, is, I believe, of both Mexican and Native American heritage. Hopefully I'm getting that right. I do apologize if I am getting that wrong. I mean, by his own admission, he laments in some of the speeches about the fact that, you know, the parts he was getting offered after doing all this training in college, that were, you know, like, you're playing the bit hoodlum on, you know, whatever, you know, it was never quality roles there. And this was one of the few times he really got something that was, you know, really he could sink his teeth into. And, you know, and again, it's very interesting, you know, Paul Bartel, I mean, the Mary Warrenov and the screenwriter of the film, Richard Blackburn, who pops up as the individual who is selling, who is trying to, is the real estate agent who's trying to get them their property. Yeah, they had to convince Bartel. It's like, no, you have to get Beltran into this movie because he was a bit wishy-washy and wanted to cast somebody, quote-unquote, older in the role. And it's like, are you kidding? Get this guy. And luckily he listened because... Yeah, no, Beltran just plays off them beautifully in this movie.
Yeah, like, I mean, I feel like we're kind of winding down and much sooner than our audience is usually pretty used to. But, like, honestly, Dave, I mean, I don't know if this film is necessarily doing much by way of broad, expansive ideas, as much as it's just picking a few smaller ideas and sticking with them and delivering on them. I guess my question to you, are there any, I guess, sort of broader elements of the film that we haven't addressed yet?
Not really. I mean, the way in which, again, wealth sort of recurs throughout the film and the idea of cheapness as a sort of recurring... you know, motif throughout the movie is interesting in the way in which people sort of, you know, what they consider cheap versus something with taste and value to it is interesting. I don't know if it's something worth exploring in a lot of depth. It's just, it plays out in a number of funny contexts, starting with the opening scene of Paul, you know, trying to upsell on the wine, and then playing out through things such as, again, Paul then having a very similar reaction with his counterpoint in a
an adult novelty
shop
store.
Yes, basically that, where you get a delightful thing where Paul calls something, asks for something cheaper, and he gets told off. It's like, don't you mean inexpensive? I don't sell anything cheap here.
Surely you meant inexpensive.
Yeah, no,
like, okay, I'm sorry. What about a harness? Oh, you want the cheap one of those too?
Yeah, exactly. And even things like when, you know, Raoul's, you know, pitching his grand vision of what him and Mary's life's going to be like and talking about these black velvet paintings. It's going to happen. It's just, again, it's just, it's such a delightful thing. And it, I mean, ultimately it climaxes on the really, probably the darkest line in the entire movie, which is, it's amazing what you can do with a cheap piece of meat. When, you know, having killed Raoul and there's no time to dispose of the body before their real estate agent shows up for a dinner, to finalize them buying, this land. The title of the film ends up being, yeah, they cook Raoul as a way to dispose of the body.
Reveal. And, the realtor, there's also that hilarious, like, dad joke, morbid punchline of, is this French? And then Mary and Paul just look at each other and say, actually, it's a bit more Spanish.
Yeah, and it's just like, oh my god, this is dark. And I mean, that's the other weird thing I would say about this movie, because there is a way, this film could easily have become very racist in how it depicts Mexican culture and, you know, Mexican-American culture there. And you know, I think Beltran definitely is onto something when he points out, you know, part of the reason that the film doesn't feel that way is because everybody comes off terrible in this movie. It's not like, you know, the attitudes that are coming from Paul and Mary are presented as ideal. They are very much wrong and terrible people, even if you do feel sympathy for them, or at least an affection for them in some way. Yeah, you recognize that, my god, these people are horrific.
But the awfulness on display, I mean, all the characters, it's a difference of degree, but never of kind. So it's just a question of, like, you know, there are no heroes and villains. There's just better people and worse people. The same way that, like, you know, this film doesn't really even have a climax all that much. I mean, the apartment scene in the standoff when a drunk Raoul shows up and, you know, unveils his master plan, like, it's not much of, like, it's not a scene that's played for suspense. And, I mean, it's resolved just as neatly by Mary saying she can't find the frying pan, everyone walks off screen, and then you hear the telltale thunk, and that's that. You know, it's like, and that strikes me as, this is not a film that's remotely concerned with, like, traditional narrative structure or trapping. Like, everything that's happening in the film is because that's what the people making it want to happen. And so there's this weird sense of purposeness, purpose, I suppose, does. There's this weird sense of purpose to everything that's on display, where it's so economical, like, by its production design, like, when you're shooting on used film ends from other bigger studios, you do not have the luxury of wasting scenes. When everybody's working on a shoestring budget and, like, not getting paid, and you're churning this out in, like, 20 days or whatever it took to shoot this, like, everything that's on screen is there as a deliberate choice. And I think that's why there's that weird sense of unity, as opposed to, you look at, you know, 1970s grindhouse flicks that play at the drive-in. It's just, well, we have a concept that might scare some teens, so if we rush this out the door for no money and we make some money, it'll be a big hit. And that attitude and that sort of haphazardness is really missing here. Like, this is not the most polished film. If you're able to, the Criterion release of it does a really, really solid restoration. Apparently all the quality differences from scene to scene have been smoothed out. Like, it looks great, it sounds great, and you would never know watching it on Criterion that this film was basically made for next to nothing over 30 years ago. But yeah, there's that weird sense of shared purpose and a shared idea, whether between Paul and Mary as characters or between Paul and Mary as people making this film. There is that sense of unity, and it really causes the film to stand out. Not just against, like, other dark territory films, But even just against all other films that came after, there's something about this film that resists being slotted next to anything else.
No, absolutely. And I mean, you know, yeah, when you get something that unique, you have to just sort of give it up to them because, you know, that's a rare thing to achieve in any medium. And, you know, kudos to them, to everybody involved in this production, because, you know, you pull it off and we salute you. But I guess with that, Andrew, I guess this should bring us probably to our patent pending, you know, hits and pits. I'm not sure whether our war with the patent office should be something we go into, but,
well, they were about to approve, and then they decided that we didn't actually have enough episodes under our belt to count because they didn't recognize last week as a full one. So we got to wait a little bit longer.
Duh. All right, then. So let's start. Is there any hits, Andrew, that you would like to highlight that we haven't done so far?
Oh, man. I mean, there are so many, to be honest. And, like, I don't know what to do. I would say that Susan Sager playing Doris when she tries to put the scare into Raoul by playing the immigration agent, that's another area where it could be just an absurd collection of stereotypes or stock dialogue. And instead, the way that she plays it and like the way that she completely commits to her character committing to a performance, it creates this doubled absurdity. So the fact that he walks away because he knows his papers are in order, and her response is to immediately just, like, throw on her aviators and start saying, "You don't want to cross me, boy, or I'll throw your ass over the Rio Grande first thing in the morning." And, like, it comes off as just so comical. But I think it also underscores just the inherent performativity of Doris in King culture, and Doris as, you know, helping out her friend Paul like a good neighbor would. Again, it's just one of those weird little details that just made me laugh for reasons I might not even be able to articulate. But, yeah, I think it just more than anything underscored that Doris the Dominatrix ends up being, like, the most wonderful and, like, kind character in the film. And any time that you can say that sentence, you know you're watching something weird. So, what about you, Dave?
I mentioned him earlier, but I gotta give another shout-out to Don Steele. Because, A, I have voice envy. I'm not gonna lie. He was a, for those who don't know, he was a radio DJ through a large chunk of the past several decades before he, I believe, passed away early in the 2000s. But he shows up as the host of the climactic swingers party that Paul and Mary attend in an effort to try and raise a lot of money very quickly and succeed in doing. And he is just a hyperactive lunatic there, and the way in which he's sort of just announcing everything in this, you know, clear radio announcing voice, "I'm out there and doing things." That's not actual dialogue. I can't repeat a word he says, but he is just a pure delight. And once he gets, you know, his volatileness when he gets in the hot tub and starts yelling at Paul and Mary and saying, you know, get out of your clothes, get in the hot tub, or get the heck out of here. He's just like, just, I don't know why I find it so, you know, hilarious, but he really almost comes off like, you know, what if Daffy Duck was successful and terrible and sleazy? And
yeah, there's something funny about the idea of, like, a successful man in Hollywood who has nothing better to do than sit in his hot tub and scream at people for not taking their clothes off. I mean, through the lens of 2018, that ends up becoming strangely relevant again, and it's not as comical. But the way that, like, the fact that Don Steele plays him and makes him look like a complete and total buffoon through and through tempers that as well. Like, he's a guy that is clinging to 70s fashion with his dying breath.
No, absolutely. And he popped up in Paul Bartel's Death Race 2000 as well, where he plays the commentator on the race throughout the film. And he is a pure delight in that one movie as well. So I'm kind of sorry to see that he didn't have more work. I mean, he had a very narrow range he could work in, but Bartel knew how to use it. So, I mean, kudos there. What else, Andrew, would you like to sort of highlight here?
I think Paul Bartel is probably has less screen time in the film than Mary Warrenoff, but I would like to give a special mention to both of them. Because, as we said, Bartel not only acts, but he also co-wrote and directed the film. And he is bringing out some very, very transgressive ideas and presenting them in a way that I don't think any other filmmaker could do so successfully. But I think a big part of why those ideas work, and why a lot of, like, the commentary and humor alike both work, is the performance by Mary Warrenoff. I had never seen her in a film prior. I think she's amazing here. You know, she hits so many different notes of, she can be like the inert asexual housewife. She can be like the inept schemer. She can be like a willing murderer. She can be the waifish damsel being stolen by Raoul, and she can be the woman that asserts herself. And she goes through all those modes, and it feels organic and natural, or at least as natural as anything in a film as deliberately bent as this ever could. And I mean, I just love, I love her aggressive voice that she adopts when she starts acting out as a dominatrix figure herself, where she just like furrows her brow and, "Listen up, worm." And then like always making sure, "And make sure you bring cash, you little jerk." And, like, I don't know, there's just something, like, so hesitant in her delivery of it while trying to sound so commanding that it just comes off as so delightful. I really liked her performance. I have a deep and newfound admiration for Paul Bartel, and both of those came out through this movie. So, what about you, Dave?
Another thing I guess to sort of highlight here in terms of just, like, I mean, there's so many little small roles we could highlight here that I think are worth doing. Like, Richard Paul is Mr. Cray, the liquor store owner. You know, his brief amount of screen time is hilarious. And, you know, again, in what is a scene that, again, in 2018, probably plays a bit darker than it did in 1982, where he guns down and then, without missing a beat, continues to chew up Paul, a hold-up man. Is remarkably fascinating. Hamilton Camp as the dishonest wine buyer early on in the film, who scams Paul into paying for a meal and runs off with his wine, is, you know, interesting for us a little bit. Even Alan Rich, the individual who, you know, we spent an entire episode not talking about, is, you know, in his one scene as the tedious dude who wants to appear to be a Nazi is part of his, you know, weird fantasy that he's trying to engage in. You know, he's playing it up as a cartoon, to the hilt as a cartoon, but, you know, it's kind of amusing the way in which he sort of captures all those really terrible Nazi exploitation films and performances, yeah, you would see.
And the fact
that
his entire scene, he like plays it out like he's giving a dramatic monologue, and it's like makes you think that he showed up to the house with like his bag full of gear and his Nazi flags to pin up on the wall and like a 40-page script that he had to memorize, and like just the over the topness in how overwrought that sequence comes off as. It's impossible not to laugh. And again, 2018 colors that a little bit, but I don't know. Like, there's something about the film's sensibility where it seems to sidestep that, and I think it's because it never comes off like it's punching down.
Well, it's the thing where, you know, you look at Paul and Mary, and they clearly can't stand this guy. I mean, it's a film that very much acknowledges this guy's trash, and, you know, even our terrible characters can't stand dealing with him. To add to the final punchline, the fact that he brought a check when he was told explicitly to bring cash, like, everything about this guy is just wrong and horrible, is just, you know, again, sort of whole, you know, he's a holistically terrible individual, here, and the film doesn't make us feel otherwise. So, kudos, I guess. But it also brings up, I mean, the fact that, I guess it's maybe worth noting, is that this is a film set in Hollywood that remarkably isn't about the film industry.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a film about performance, and I think that means certainly the setting sort of heightens that. But yeah, no, this is not a film about anybody trying to make it. It's just a little detail that, if nothing else, explains why Paul and Mary have access to all sorts of prop rental shops for the various things they need for their scheme to work. It's, yeah, so again, nice touch there. But of course, you know, I think we've, you know, come up with quite a few hits. Are there any pits, Andrew?
Well, I think this is almost like a meta pit. And because I think it's safe to say that you really enjoyed this film, and I, yeah, for reasons I still can't totally explain, I the only thing keeping me from recommending this film to everyone is recognizing that this is not a film for everyone.
Yeah.
But I think if anything we've discussed sounds appealing to you, watch this film, because you'll have an experience. But let me put it to you this way, and we sort of brought up the topic of whether the film is, if we can read it as social satire, or even like some kind of misguided comedy of manners. But I read an article recently, I think it was on Medium, about South Park, and specifically about South Park and sort of its connection to the rise of troll culture and the alt-right. And at first I dismissed this article as like, oh, it's just reactionism. But the more I read it, the more I thought about the point that they bring up, which is South Park became famous for treating everybody as a target. And even though it was in bad taste, even though sometimes it was funny and people eventually convinced themselves it was brilliant, effectively all the show did was just lampoon everyone and everything. And I guess my question is it still the same kind of commentary or the same kind of like socially concerned film when there's so much on display that we're being told is ridiculous and like deflating the air out of everything? But at the end of the film, like, what's this film for? Like, is there a moral thrust to this film beyond everybody that currently lives in California is garbage? And I guess my question is, like, it's all well and good to sort of mock the cultures in life that you don't care for, but I guess to what end? And does the fact that the film doesn't really seem to have anything concrete to say in terms of, like, positivity, not in the sense of, like, an uplifting message, but just in terms of, like, construction, like, is this film making any kind of larger point beyond lampooning? And then follow-up question, does that existence or lack of a point, is that a deal-breaker for you?
I will say this. I think there are a couple things, I think, to say in response. Number one, as far as the idea of there being a large point, I think part of the thing with satire is, again, satire is about pointing out problems. It's not necessarily about offering solutions or anything like that. And this film doesn't, I mean, it points out, you know, the ridiculousness of the values of the Blands, of the values of the Swingers. Like, it really takes to task the sort of notion of what is wrong with them as people, and what they choose to value and what they choose to put, you know, stock in. But, and I think that in and of itself is the point. And I think that is valuable. Whether you feel, one feels it's facile or something that has been said elsewhere, you know, sometimes, yeah, that mirror helps. And the fact that it is so both specific to its moment, because I again, we can't deny that you and I were, you know, we're born in the mid-80s. We're approaching this, you know, from the perspective of 2018. You know, I imagine, you know, this film came out 2 years before I was even around. So for the people who this film was originally made for, you know, this probably played, you know, in a very different way, had much more meaning to them, as it were. And any sort of movement away from that is probably just the nature of time itself. I mean, I don't think we can get away from that. I would say that also the difference, what makes this film different, I would say, from, say, South Park, though, is that the problem with South Park, and that is an interesting note, I haven't read the article you're talking about per se, but what is worth noting is that part of the problem with South Park is that it's been going on forever. And because it's part of that grill of we always need something, we always need the next thing to go after there, South Park really ends up being this, you know, everything has to be a target and everything to the point where it maybe it is meaninglessness. And it doesn't help that I think the difference also being that Paul Bartel, you know, there is, again, he's very idiosyncratic in his vision. He is somebody who has a very particular view on things. And that view in and of itself, I think, may also be viewed as the point. It's, we're seeing his artistic slant on things. But beyond that as well, I mean, certainly I think the problem with Trey Parker and Matt Stone is that they are individuals who basically announced, you know, because they announced War on Everybody. I mean, there was a period of time where that was, you know, understandable. I mean, you know, pointing out the hypocrisy and things of things is certainly valuable. I certainly think they found a lot of humor in it. What's changed is the fact that, you know, in 2018, you know, there are some very decisive differences between, certainly the powers that be and the alternative things, and the way that they've sort of approached their satire hasn't changed. You know, they, part of the problem, I would say, is that, you know, they're trying to sit there and say, well, there's still no sides in anything. And, you know, I don't know whether that really plays in 2018 when you have individuals such as Trump in power and the way in which they are hitting down and hitting down
hard.
Well,
yeah. In 2000, to say, like, Republicans and Democrats are the same because their policies are identical and they both receive corporate money, you can do that. If in 2018, though, and you say, well, Republicans and Democrats are the same. How so? They both take corporate money. And there's a couple pretty big differences after that point. So maybe it's also, maybe it's because we're experiencing this at a remove and because we're not seeing it in its original context. Like, I don't know. I guess, like, I'm not necessarily even saying that it's a problem, that the film doesn't come out and say, see, it turns out that it was good old-fashioned monogamous marital values that saved the day for everyone. Like, the film doesn't do that, and it probably doesn't need to. It just, it's more that conventionally, like, when we encounter, like, famous satire, like, there's at least an implicit solution. Like, even if in Jonathan Swift, and the solution is, well, stop listening to the English, you know? It's just, it's odd because, and I think maybe it's fitting given the spirit of the film and those idiosyncrasies in Paul Bartel's work that it resists even doing that. It just struck me as a bit odd, and I think it may also be owing to the fact that this film was made under clear deadlines with some clear limitations. The fact that it is very episodic, and the fact that, like, whatever we're seeing is sort of, like, the maximal version of what it could have been at any given time. I don't know. That was just something I found myself thinking about.
You know, and it's worth, I mean, it's certainly worth exploring. I mean, ultimately, I don't know whether there's a good answer I can say. I mean, certainly, to me, it's not a deal breaker. I mean, it's very much the case of, you know, if I enjoy the film enough, and, you know, those outside questions aren't bothering me, you know, I'm pretty much with it. I mean, and again, that's kind of a case-by-case basis. But, I mean, to me, it almost feels like too much weighty a question to put on what was ultimately a very personal, no-budget
comedy. Oh, and I agree with you completely. This was probably not a question that anybody brought to the film. But, yeah, it's also just, again, like, The same thematic territory in 1982 is, like, side-splittingly hilarious despite being morbid, whereas when you suddenly remember that these themes are very much discussed and circulated in news media today, and, like, the ensuing traumas that correspond to some of these themes are still very real and very, very felt and embodied by people living in the world as of now, that it, I guess I'm wondering, how is it that more time goes by and then suddenly we realize these issues are more relevant, even though they're longstanding issues that have been around forever? And I think that's just a testament to the fact that there's going, I don't think that you can apply any singular reading to this film that's going to apply all the time and unilaterally. Like, this feels like a film that was almost designed to always have that one part that resists. And, you know, it is maddening. It is kind of frustrating in its own way. It's certainly not a prestige picture, but it's also, it's a one-of-a-kind film. And I think anybody who thinks that, you know, they can be on board to at least see what this film is like, willing to give it a chance before saying not for me and then watching something else, I think you would do worse than throwing this film on. Because yeah, I've seen a lot of out there movies, most of them garbage, some of them very good. I would say this is one of the strangest films I have ever seen, and of that list of strangest films, probably among the better ones.
No, absolutely. And yeah, I think with that, that's probably a good place to sort of wrap it up.
Okay.
So yeah, that was my pick for this week. But Andrew, I believe you're picking next. So I mean, where are you taking us? Are we going to the 90s, the 2000s, back to the 40s, or maybe you find a way to get us to the 60s? Like, where are we going next? What year, what decade?
We are actually taking a very, very lateral jump here. Instead, we're going from Midtown LA to basically the San Fernando Valley and the Hollywood Hills to 1982 for another low, well, not independent, but it feels very independent, and in its production history, it ended up being a very independent film. And we will be looking at Samuel Fuller's social drama, maybe? White Dog, which follows Paul Bartel, who, art imitating life, appears as a camera operator. It is a film that is well regarded, only in hindsight, as a misunderstood gem upon its release, and using the story of a young girl bonding with an animal, explores questions of racism, hatred, whether or not behaviors can be unlearned, and whether or not anybody had as commanding a stage presence as Paul Winfield. So I'm very excited to talk to this one. I think it allows us to pull out some themes that we've been kicking around for the last few weeks and hopefully finally get some clear answers on them. And I know that even if I don't enjoy the film, somehow I got a feeling that talking about with Dave will help me at least learn a thing or two. So yes, you can find us next week when we prepare to drop that one. In the meantime, Dave, if anybody wants to yell at us for recommending such a crass and tasteless movie, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me at 24 Panels on Twitter. And how about you, Andrew?
You can find me on Twitter as well at FilmStripper, and proud to announce that a couple weeks ago I mentioned outsourcing web design work. I have found a guy that's willing to do it. So more details on that to come as it appears. As well, if you want to rate or review us on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are distributed, reviews through iTunes are usually the best way to get more eyes and ears on the product. Obviously, five-star reviews are the biggest mover in that regard, but if there are things that, you know, you wish we would do more of or less of, please let us know. Honesty is important, and again, we can't fix anything if we don't know it's broken. So feel free to let us know, and you know, sooner or later we'll respond to all of your very kindly worded and incredibly terse emails. So, Dave, any other business to go over?
No, I think that just about covers it for this episode. So, what parting words would you like to leave us with today, Andrew?
Well, those parting words I always leave them with, Dave. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless I have a frying pan and find you first. Bye!